I would like to make this something, you know, different than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for beginners. I want to start at that more advanced level, as it were. Assume that you know, for example, that what we are dealing with is a colonial conflict, basically. I mean, this is basic stuff. That the Zionist project was and is the project of colonization, and the Israeli state, which is a product of it and an instrument for its further advancement or extension, is a colonial settler state. These are basic facts, and I'm going to take them for granted. I'm going to actually look at the more nuanced picture, starting from there. I mean, this is only the, you know, the rudiment. Also, I'm speaking as a socialist. I'm not speaking as a sort of general, let's say, do-gooder support for justice. Although support for justice is necessary. I'm not knocking it, but I want to argue a specifically socialist point of view. And this is, I think, this requires some arguing, because, all socialists instinctively almost will support the liberation struggle of an oppressed group, and the Palestinians are evidently, and again, one doesn't need to argue this, an oppressed people. So support for their liberation, support for their struggle. I think one can take this for granted, but very often socialists look at the actual movement that is leading that struggle, and very often quite uncritically take, as it were, off the peg the politics, the ideology of that movement. And this doesn't apply only to the Palestinian case. It applies to other cases of national liberation, and indeed not only to national liberation, but all sorts of liberation movements that are not explicitly and overtly class-based. I mean, socialists have a problem with liberation movements that are not based on directly on class antagonism. And this applies, I mean, a major example is national liberation. And they often uncritically take the ideology of the leadership of that movement and adopt it without being critical about it. And I think this is where I want to start and take a more critical position. Support for Palestinian liberation, yes, support for the Palestinian struggle, yes, but socialists have to exercise independent thought and analysis. What I want to argue is that actually the problem of the liberation of the Palestinian people, the resolution of the conflict, is inseparable from the struggle for socialism. And I want to explain why this is. That it's not something that is, as it were, freestanding. It has to do with the specific nature of this problem. I'm not going to argue a general thesis that all national liberation is inherently tied up with the struggle for socialism. That is to say that problems of national oppression everywhere can only be resolved by socialism. I'm not going to argue, this may or may not be true. I'm going to argue the specific case under consideration, where there are specific arguments for. Now, I mean, this actually works both ways. I think it is impossible to struggle for socialism in Israel-Palestine without struggling against Zionism. Now, this is not only for moral reasons, it's also true for moral reasons, because you can't struggle for socialism without supporting liberation of oppressed groups, and the major oppressed group is the Palestinian people in that part of the world. But it's also true for a more profound structural reasons, because struggling against capitalism is not, I mean, you have to take into consideration the actual structure of capitalism as a world system. Capitalism as a world system is not a flat kind of uniform structure of capitalist states that have all the same, more or less the same symmetric role in the overall global structure. It's a global system which has its own structure, and each state is articulated in this structure in a specific way. And the way the Israeli state is articulated in the global system of capitalism is as a colonial settler state, specifically as a Zionist state. Now, I could spend my whole half hour arguing this point. I want to just leave it as they just state it, because I want to argue the converse of this connection, that you cannot actually struggle successfully to resolve the problem, the national problem of the Palestinian people. You cannot actually defeat Zionism except as part of a struggle for socialism. That is to say, I'm not going to argue, and please don't misinterpret me and say that you have to put aside the struggle for the liberation of the Palestinian people and let it be resolved by the victory of socialism in the maybe distant future. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's a lot that one can do here and now in defense of the Palestinian people. But this is mainly defensive action. This is not, this kind of action short of a socialist revolution, I don't think, and I'm going to explain why, I don't think it's going to resolve the problem. So there's plenty to do now, and one must do it, but one shouldn't engage in illusions. And there have been a lot of illusions about this, as though the problem can be resolved short of a major social transformation of the whole region. Now, why is this? On the face of it, the problem is a problem of decolonization. As I started by saying, that the conflict is a colonial conflict. Israel and the Zionist project, which it embodies, is a colonial project. The Palestinian people are the indigenous people of the area that has been colonized. So the resolution of the problem is decolonization. And there has been, on the face of it, plenty of decolonization. They didn't need to wait for a worldwide socialist revolution. They've been, done. And in fact, the only important outstanding colonial conflict is the one we are talking about. Not long ago, there was the one before last, which was South Africa. And this has been resolved in the sense that the formal structure of a colonial settler state has been dismantled. Now, please, don't interpret me as saying that South Africa, as it is now, has overcome all the after effects and the long-term effects of colonialism. It hasn't. And nor have other places which were liberated, which were decolonized earlier, like Algeria and earlier examples. The after effects, the long-term effects of colonialism are still with us, and quite evidently. But the formal structure, the legal structure of settler states are no longer. So what's so special about the case of Palestine? Why not there? Why cannot it, and the South African analogy is mentioned very often. You hear a lot about apartheid in Israel-Palestine. And in a sense, it's true because there are many similarities, many phenomena that are very reminiscent of apartheid. But in fact, I think this is very misleading and very superficial, because one has to look more closely at colonial conflicts and see what is the specificity of the case we are talking about. Now, as a matter of fact, I think a measure of Marxist analysis is necessary here. And something which was obvious to Marxists quite a long time ago, and should be obvious to Marxists, a point that is made but is not made by other supporters of national liberation. I think the first to make this point, to my knowledge, was Karl Kautsky, more than 100 years ago. And he said, look, there are two models, two kinds of colonialism. For a Marxist, this is not a big discovery, but it's a necessary point to make. And they differ in their political economy. Now, this is a schematic, of course. I'm here making a schema, but a useful schema. They differ in their political economy. One kind of colonialism is exploitative colonialism, all colonialism is exploitative. I mean, the colonizers exploit the resources of the country which they colonize. But the specific question is, where does the surplus product come from? This is what a Marxist should ask. Where does it come from, and what is the form of its extraction? And specifically, in the case of a colonial situation, what is the source of the surplus? Is it the labor power of the indigenous people, or is it not? What befalls the indigenous people? Now, the distinction between the two models of colonization is that in the exploitative model, which is exemplified, if you like, by South Africa, a very outstanding and very clear example of this, at least as it has evolved in the 19th century, is that the whole political economy of the country is based on exploiting the labor power of the indigenous people. The indigenous people themselves are a resource for exploitation. Not only the natural resources, not only the land and the water and the mineral resources, in the case of South Africa, very important, the mineral resources, but the labor power, the whole political economy is actually built basically on that. Now, in these colonies, the settlers, the conflict between settlers and the indigenous people evolved as a quasi-class conflict. It's not that all the settlers were of one class and all the indigenous people were of one class, but overall, it almost looks as though it is like this. And as a necessary part of this, the settlers were and remained always a fairly small minority. If you look at South Africa, if you look before it at Algeria, which is also an instance of this model of colonization. This is one type. The other type, Kautsky called working colonies, and we in the organization that I belong to, and which made this analysis quite a long time ago, we called it exclusionary, not exploitative, but exclusion colonialism, where the indigenous population is not used as a source of labor power, but is actually excluded, ethnically cleansed, if you like, either by outright extermination, the most extreme example of this is probably Tasmania, where the indigenous population was almost totally exterminated. There were other places that approached it, I think that in the Caribbean, in some places and others. Or pushed out, or segregated, undercut in various ways, overwhelmed. And in this model, the settler people evolve into a new nation. You have a new nation forming in which all classes are represented. And you have this in the United States, you have it in Australia, you have it in New Zealand. Look around, there are many examples of this. And Zionist colonization belongs to this latter model. In other words, it quite consciously in this case, it didn't happen consciously in all cases of this model, but in the case of Zionism, it happened in a very planned and deliberate way. The indigenous people were to be ethnically cleansed and not used as a source of labor. Okay? And what actually happened was the formation of a new nation, which is often referred to as the Israeli Jews. I prefer the term Hebrews, which is also sometimes used. I think it's clearer because it doesn't have a religious connotation and because it focuses on one of the attributes that is unique to this nation, namely use of the Hebrew language as an everyday language of discourse and secular use. Ironically, the Zionist movement that actually, as it were, produced this nation denies its existence because according to Zionist ideology, all the Jews around the world constitute a nation, and the Holy Land is their ancient homeland, and the Israeli Jews are just part of that nation who happen to have been the vanguard of the whole nation in returning to the ancient homeland. This is a myth, of course. But this myth in Zionist ideology leads to a denial of the existence of a real actual new nation that was formed as a result of Zionist colonization. Okay, now if you look at the fate of decolonization, keeping in mind the distinction between the two models, you see something very striking. In all cases of exploitative colonization, decolonization was not only possible, but has actually taken place. Finished. South Africa is the last example of this. Okay? And it didn't take a socialist revolution to achieve this. It was feasible within existing capitalism. On the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, put the case of Palestine aside, in all other cases of exclusionary colonialism, where the indigenous population was not used as labor power, decolonization has not taken place. Not only has it not taken place, it is not even on the agenda. In the following sense, I mean, the indigenous people in North America or in Australia, those who remain overwhelmed by the settlers, but they do fight for equal rights. They do fight for their human rights. They do fight for the possibility, for the ability to develop their ancient language and culture and so on. The struggle is ongoing. In Australia, it's an outstanding example. It's still on. But one thing is not on the agenda, and that is for these indigenous people to reclaim their ancient homeland. There is no national liberation. It is not really something that is on. In fact, in none of these cases, to my knowledge, do you have what you have in the case of Palestine, not one nation forming, that is of the settlers, but actually two new nations forming. Two quite distinct and well-defined national groups. Not only the settler national group, the Hebrew nation, but also the Palestinian national entity. And that is also something that has evolved as a direct result of Zionist colonization. It's not something that existed previously. And I want to make it clear, you see, here is where socialist analysis differs from nationalist ideology. In nationalist ideology, there is a myth of an ancient homeland that has always existed, and an ancient, long existing national entity that needs to be liberated and so on. Actually, if you look closely at these things, they are mostly myths. And in fact, the reality is quite different. As a matter of fact, a very important ingredient is the fetishization of the real estate that is known as the homeland, the national territory, which is sort of holy, sacred real estate. Now, this is clearly visible in Zionism. I mean, in the case of Zionism, you don't, it's often said, you don't have to believe in God to be a Zionist, but you do have to believe that God promised the Holy Land to the Jews. This you do have to believe. But it's also true, I mean, you hear Palestinian nationalists talk about historic Palestine.